Hello and thank you for listening to episode 295 of 60MW. I'm Dave and this is number 6 in our Grimfest interview shows. And in this one I talk to director John Hyams about his movie Alone. Again, this is another one that's on our YouTube channel, so if you're not already subscribed, please go over there, link in the podcast notes. Give us a sub on there and you can also watch me and John have a chat as well. And again, you can win a free Grimfest code to watch this. All you got to do is wait until the end of the show. I will give you the special Grimfest word. Be the first to email it to us and you get a free pass to watch Alone. So without further ado, let's get on with the chat. So sit back, relax, get comfortable. And here's me and John Hyams talking about Alone. Hi, John.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
How's things been going? Have you had a lot of interviews?
Oh yeah, well, I've been doing it this week. I mean, it's great. I'm happy to get to talk about the movie and you know have discussion about it. So I enjoy that. I'm also, this is my first week of shooting. We've resumed production on a show that I created for Netflix. We're doing our second season of a show called Black Summer, mm-hmm. and so. So that production shooting just started last week. So it was a exciting, eventful week. And nice to be back into it. So
oh, yeah.
Happy with all this.
A little bit of normality at last.
Yeah, that's right. You know, as different as it is, I mean, we're out there, there's a lot of new procedures and regulations. We're all wearing masks and goggles. It's a very, you know, so there's an element to it that's different and cumbersome and kind of takes getting used to, and your goggles fog up and all these things. And then after a while, once you're sort of rolling cameras, it suddenly actually feels normal and great again. So it's been really nice getting back to it. And, you know, we're just kind of at the beginning of our second leg of production. Will take us through October.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed it can carry on, and there's nothing, surely nothing else can happen.
Careful what you say.
It's crazy. Yeah, I'm so pleased that people are getting back and production starting on TV shows and movies and everything, because that's what helps people get through things like this is entertainment and, you know, the creative arts.
Absolutely. You know, it was interesting because we're up in Canada here, and you know, they don't let U.S. citizens into Canada right now, but we were able to get in. You know, again, Netflix is the company behind us. So basically, we've been deemed essential workers in order to get across the border here. And on one hand, that may be a stretch, but on the other hand, I feel like, you know what? Hey, maybe. Maybe we're providing a service everybody needs right now. So
I'd agree with that. I would definitely.
Well, maybe there's some truth to it.
Oh yeah, I've been missing like new going to the cinema for one thing. Was not been doing that for ages. New films coming out. It's because I'm a big cinephile.
That's tough. That's tough, and I miss that. I miss live events, whether it's sporting events or movies, of course, or concerts. Those things. That's the part where, you know, there's always going to be a strong desire for communal experience of entertainment. And as much as I've, let's face it, a great deal of my favorite films I've ever seen and ones that influenced me profoundly, there's certainly a large percentage of them that I watched at home on home video, when I was young. But, that being said, there's still nothing like being in a big darkened room with other people, your attention all focused on the screen.
Yeah.
And I think especially for certain genres, of course, comedy with a group is amazing, but horror and thrillers, watching those on a Saturday night, 10 p.m. showing, you know, is always the most fun way to do it. I mean, I'll never forget my experience of seeing the first Alien in the theater. I was probably 9 years old, and my older brother and myself and my friend, my mom dropped us off and bought the tickets for us so we could go in. It was a neighborhood theater. And sitting in that big dark room with this huge screen and being immersed in this world, it was so tense and terrifying. And then the chest burster scene happened, and my older brother got up and sprinted out of the theater and he ran home. So now it was just me and my friend in this theater. And by the time you get to the last act of that movie, we were literally huddled together, like a couple of schoolgirls, you know, just completely, just trying to make it through the experience. And when it ended, I mean, it still to this day is the most frightened I've ever been in a movie, and the most intense experience I've ever had watching a movie. And I think that's, you know, it's moments like that that make you want to be, make you want to make films, you know, make you want to put an audience through incredible experience.
I had just the same watching Jaws as a kid. My dad took me to Jaws when it opened up, and I was 10 when it opened up. He is 75, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I was 10, and he took me, and I was so scared and loved being so scared that I asked him, will you take me the next night? And God bless him, he did. He took me two nights running to watch, and I was scared stiff. And that was it then. That was the film that got me hooked on cinema, especially within the horror genre. So, yeah, I'd love
to. Oh, for sure. Jaws came, you know, I didn't get to see Jaws on the first go round, but back then they used to re-release movies. So I actually saw Alien before I saw Jaws, but then Jaws made it in re-release.
I remember Alien over here. I remember one of the national tabloids opening it up, and it was the center spread, and it was a huge picture of an audience watching Alien, and it was, is this the scariest movie ever made? And it was just a whole cinema full of people just screaming like this.
Yeah, for me it was. And I had also seen, I had seen every slasher movie that came out soon after, and I had, you know, I loved horror movie. I loved monster movies as a kid. I loved monster movie makeup. I always thought when I was young that I wanted to be a, you know, makeup effects. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be Dick Smith. And still to this day, again, it's my 10-year-old self, but still to this day, that experience of the first Alien, nothing has ever compared to that for me in terms of something that scared me to the point where I didn't know if I could make it through the movie. You know, it was such a visceral experience that Ridley Scott created. Definitely. And I think in some ways I've always been chasing that in some way. How do you create something that is visceral like that? How do you create? And in many ways, Alone, while a vastly different movie, but it was a chance to focus purely on just kind of as an experiment for myself. How do I just create kind of crystallized exercise in tension and creating tension, and how can you sustain the tension, and you know, when do you relieve it a little bit? How much can you wind it up? Doing the, you know, what creates tension? When do you lose it? So it was in many ways like, so every project you embark on, there's something that is drawing you to it. And in this one, it was really, how do I create just a binary experience? Because I feel like genre films, certain ones, really are that. They either kind of can hold your attention, and either, if it's a comedy, make you laugh. That's a very binary experience. If you don't laugh, then it didn't work for you. Or if you don't find it funny. Mm-hmm. And for a thriller, which is different than horror in a certain way, but they're obviously cousins. But, you know, the suspense thriller, you know, in the Hitchcock sense, where you are just kind of playing with the tension and expectations of the audience, and you're leaning into the expectations, and then trying to take a turn just when they're, even that turn can be a subtle thing. It can just be not delivering with the rhythm that they're expecting, you know, sustaining a shot and not cutting until they expected, all little things, not giving them the music they want or taking the music away. So it sounds like a very technical exercise, but all movies have that element. And then of course it comes down to, performers who are going to engage you. And that's in the end, the most important thing.
Yeah. But the loan is essentially a two-hander, isn't it? For virtually all the way through it. And it's two such great actors that pull it off all the way through, that get you invested in their characters from either side. It just drew me straight into it all the way through and didn't let go. I think when I emailed you, I said it took me ages to prise my fingers from the sides of the couch after watching it. And that's testament to the performance as well.
I mean, and that is all them, of course. You can only be the audience can only be frightened if the character is convincingly frightened, you know? And so much of your casting decisions in these things comes down to finding a performers that pull the audience in, you know, and this one especially, because it's very minimalistic, very light on exposition, dialogue. There's a lot of, you know, non-dialogue periods of time in the movie. So you need, certainly in the character of Jessica, you needed an actor who kind of could just pull you in, that meaning that you could kind of project onto their face and onto their energy. There was something internal about it. And some of those things are physical, her eyes, things that pull you in. And some of it is, a great deal of it is just their behavior and their essence. And I felt like that was, you know, if you think about great horror films, take The Shining as an example, you know, that Shelley Duvall's character is by no means an antagonist. She's the protagonist in some ways, or she is, you know, one of our heroes. But the casting of her was brilliant because nobody could look haunted in the way that Shelley Duvall does, you know, in quite the same way that Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby. There's something as a haunted quality about her that is part of, that's another part of what is frightening the audience. It's not just that they're afraid of Jack Nicholson. They're looking at Shelley Duvall, and that's making them frightened viscerally. And not frightened of her, but she's kind of, it's like Edward Munch's Scream. It's like she's, her expression in her essence is creating an unsettled feeling in the audience. So your hero, your protagonist in a thriller has to do that somehow for the audience. You of course have to care about them, but you have, when they're frightened, it has to make you frightened. When they're tense, that has to translate to you. And it's something more than just acting frightened and something more than just being tense. It's kind of, again, it's sort of a visceral connection to a particular performer. And in this case, one that was very internal. And by the same token, I felt like Mark Menchaca needed to be both, because he needed to, there was a number of different ways of casting that role. You could either cast the role completely like against type and find sort of a leading man type, or a kind of Jimmy Stewart type that now has to convince us of his danger and malevolence. Or you could cast someone who's just already a very character, you know, creepy type. But neither one of those seemed to be the right idea. If you went with the Jimmy Stewart route, then it's like, okay, this whole thing is like, do we buy how malevolent this guy is and how dangerous he is? And he doesn't, and you want someone that's kind of making you unsettled when you first meet him, that you're judging him, but you're not sure. If he's overtly terrifying, that doesn't work either. And Mark Menchaca, again, he leaned right into it. And I love him, you know, because he's actually, I think he's an incredible actor, and he's also one of like the most charismatic, fun, beautiful guys ever. Like he, you know, Mark is just the life of the party always. When Mark tells a story, you want to hear it. They're always good stories. He's just a lot of fun as a person. And he's really funny as well. And so he kind of brought all that to it. He brought his charisma to the table, even with like a goofy mustache and like Jeffrey Dahmer glasses. He still kind of grabs your attention. So when he has to give his big speeches, he still is kind of commanding the stage. And he is, in many ways, these two actors needed to have tremendous chemistry with each other in the way that you would in a romantic comedy. You know, these two needed to have chemistry because they're essentially doing their dance through the whole story, and they're scene partners. Even when one is talking and the other one is hiding, they're always kind of in this together. And they were, you know, they were both really generous with each other. I mean, they got on great, which was important. And I think Mark made Jules feel very safe, and, you know, was kind of her, you know, he just was her friend and all the way through it. So they were really able to mix it up, and they got super physical with each other and went to some really heavy places with each other, but always, you know, always taking care of each other at the same time.
You do really buy into both characters. And like I say, it's testament to the performance of both of those. And you do with your part in it, of course. I'm glad you mentioned with shot length as well, and playing with people's expectations of that. And I love the fact that there were shots that carried on and drew out the tension, and the difference in the composition of the shots, even going into extreme close-ups. There's a shot, and again, without giving any spoilers away, there's a shot for quite a while, you're just on her eye and you're watching and the tension's building, and you're sat there almost wanting it to cut away because the tension's just getting so much. So as you're putting the film together, how do you even begin to plan things like that for how you're going to compose each shot and when you're going to hold it just that little bit more to get the audience really sucked into it?
Well, I think what you're saying is a good point, is that you're looking for, in the case of this movie, we were looking to kind of design it and construct it in a way where you're using, where you're kind of juxtaposing things that can be jarring, you know, to go from something wide to something very close, what you cut to hold on something for a while, even if it's just for a couple seconds too long, then that cut becomes forceful. And, you know, it's funny. I've seen great filmmakers do it forever. You know, I think all the best filmmakers really know how to hold a shot and how long to hold a shot. But I think someone that really started influencing me a lot, you know, probably around 15 years ago is when I started really getting into him, was Michael Haneke. And I went through a period where I was just kind of obsessively watched all. I think I first saw Caché, might have been the first one I saw. And then I did a deep dive and just kind of watched everything he did from Funny Games on. And I really think he's, you know, he's one of the real masters of cinema. And I remember in watching his movies feeling like he actually was torturing the audience in how he would hold a shot, that he would withhold a cut from you to the point where you were really getting incredibly anxious. And he did it like sadistically, and it was so effective. And if you watch any of his films, he really holds the cut over the audience. You know, he's always kind of giving you a point where you expect it and then not giving it to you and then waiting and then the making and then stretching it out beyond that point. And it's not just as simple as having a long shot. It doesn't, it's not so easy. He's making things happen in that shot too. So I've learned a tremendous amount from watching his films over and over, you know, all of them. And again, starting in the middle and then going back to the beginning, which sometimes I think is a great way to study a filmmaker's kind of filmography, is that you, I don't necessarily think you start at the beginning. I mean, you can, there's always so many ways to do it, but it's somehow, I think you start with the one in the middle or start with the one that is contemporary in that moment, if you like it, and then progressively go backwards. Because if you do that, you start to see the immediate kind of evolution versus going back to their earliest film and then somehow you might lose, you might just look at that like, well, this is kind of a crude movie. You can go back to Scorsese's student films and you may not really realize what is going on there until you kind of move your way back through Mean Streets to get there. We don't live here anymore. You know, same thing for, it's like Nolan. What was his first one? Following, I believe. Did you ever see that?
I don't know if I've seen Following. I was gonna say Prestige is an early-ish. Well, it's not that early now.
Well, no, I mean, Memento was before that.
Memento, of course,
I think Following is what it's called, and it's like a black and white, it's like a 60mm black and white movie.
Yeah.
But if you go back, you know, if you watch that, before you see The Dark Knight, you may not connect it, but if you slowly move back film by film and then you get to that, you see the roots of where these ideas started forming. So doing that with Haneke, I recommend to any student of film, start with something like Cachet, which is very, is accessible in many ways. And it's a great thriller is what it really is. But then you move backwards and you start to see, I remember one shot of a person playing ping pong or like practicing ping pong. He's just hitting the ball and it just, the shot holds and he just keeps hitting it and hitting it and hitting it. And you're just waiting and you're waiting and you say, when is this shot going to end? What's happening here? And by the end, you're just sort of like beside yourself. And then he stretches it longer and then he ends it. And all to the point that, you take a lot of that from him. I also think there's, in many ways, the shot length and how long you hold a shot is clearly an important part of building tension in a scene. But I think that, one thing everyone who makes films understands is that the audio side is ultimately, I would say, 60% of your experience, and the visual is maybe 40. I always think the audio, which is not just sound but music and putting those together, they all occupy the same space. So I don't even think of sound and music as separate elements. We try to almost think of them as a single department, sub-departments of the same department. They have to work together. You can't just have, your sound team do a sound pass and your composer does a bunch of music and then you try to mix it together in the end. Like they have to reinforce each other and stay out of each other's way and work together to create what really is the heartbeat and the pulse of the whole thing. The thing that's not just of impacting your emotions, but it's the part that is actually connecting to your heart rate. In a thriller, you're trying to manipulate someone's heart rate. And so how the audio is functioning in these scenes is really critical to what you're experiencing. And I think a lot of the lessons you learn are at times counterintuitive. When you think about a thriller, we immediately think of kind of Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann. So you think of kind of which is incredible and brilliant. You know, that his score for Psycho and all that is amazing. By the same token, heavy music and really upfront music sometimes works against tension. So it's really about where is the music, and then when do you take it away, or how does the music kind of set you up for something, but the absence of the music at times, or music that isn't doing what you think it should be doing, and at times can become more of a sound and atmosphere, which in the case of Alone, we really wanted our music to become sound at times.
Yeah.
And by doing that, you're again taking the audience's expectations, and then you're kind of subverting them. And then if the audience doesn't have music in a given moment, then they're not able to anticipate when the thing is going to happen that they're waiting to happen.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of, you know, that's the fun you can have with it is trying to use that and use quiet moments to actually create, you know, even more tension than a moment that has pulse pounding, you know, music. So I think the audio is in the, not just the level of it, but the choice of what is the choice of what you're hearing is the secret weapon of cinema. Really. I think all great films are operating on an audio level that is sometimes far more complex than what's happening visually.
It is. And it is that fine line of using the sound. And something that jumped to mind was Hitchcock's Frenzy, where he's outside and there's the hustle and the bustle of the street, and he walks into a building and the whole soundtrack goes silent as he walks up the stairs, and that really builds the tension.
Sure.
They could have put some dramatic music in there to build it up, but the use of silence in that, and it works in Alone as well. And as well as all of that, it's all wrapped around such spectacular scenery as well.
Yes.
Where was this filmed?
This was filmed just outside of Portland, in and around Portland.
Oh, okay.
And so we, we chose it specifically for the movie, really. It was kind of a rare situation. These days, you're often choosing where you shoot something based on tax incentives and things like that. But yeah. Our budget was so small that in the end, that all those tax incentives were fairly negligible in terms of the difference from one to another. And we just were able to make the decision, well, where should we shoot this? And we all immediately agreed that the Pacific Northwest had the kind of landscape that we were looking for, something that your character could really get lost in it, with the kind of rainforest and the massive, just the scale of the trees and the cliffs. And you know, we wanted something. Our setting is obviously a huge character in the film, and you want it to be both, you know, beautiful and breathtaking, but also threatening at the same time, and threatening because of its vastness.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of escaping, a dangerous situation and escaping to freedom, and then to find that now your problems just started.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about Matthias Olsen's script, was that it starts out as a very kind of, you know, woman versus man, duel like standoff, or kind of cat and mouse thing on the road, and then it becomes sort of woman versus man, woman versus nature, almost like a deliverance-like scenario in the second half. And I thought, I just loved the construction of that. It's so simple. It's a very simple movie. And that's what attracted me to making it, was I loved just how simple and basic it was from a story perspective. And that was really the challenge. You know, it's not about twists and turns. It's really about, can we take the most basic, streamlined thriller concept, of one human trying to escape another human from another human, and how to kind of manage this threat. And I loved how we could sort of celebrate the moment to moment, the kind of moment to moment challenges that she will deal with, both in the wild, in the woods, dealing with elements, dealing with physical, with injuries and the isolation of that, coupled with the idea that you are being hunted by someone that could be virtually anywhere.
Yeah.
And you're not in the desert where you can see them coming from a mile away, but you're actually in a place that's filled with obstructions and kind of shrouded, and you have no idea where civilization is because you're in the middle of something. Yeah. And I love that about the script. And in Portland, in the area surrounding it, it really has that kind of landscape. It's really kind of and very challenging to shoot within that and to shoot the way we wanted to do it. But it ultimately, I love all the settings and locations that we were able to find for this, and how we were able to utilize the landscape. And I think, again, our DP, Federico Verarde, I think he really deserves tremendous credit for shooting something in a way that's not taking the easy way for something like this, because when you're hiking in the woods, the temptation is just to kind of have, travel very small and just kind of chase everyone around with small cameras. But he was determined, and I loved his ideas and decisions to really make this still have kind of a lockdown, creeping, gliding, almost very classic approach to coverage, and taking a delicate approach to lighting and creating a harsh environment that's both, beautiful and kind of menacing at the same time. So I think he deserves a ton of credit for that.
Oh, definitely, because it does come across as both. It is beautiful to look at right from the beginning, and then it does move on to be menacing, and everything that Jessica goes through, they're all things that as a viewer you can relate to. And just one of those things is the elements, like you said, that she goes through. And because there was a lot of exterior filming there, did the elements ever conspire against you making the film? Were you ever up against it with the weather?
Oh, of course. It was a case where, it would be raining on us and then we're still making rain, but I think we didn't go to the Pacific Northwest hoping for like controllable weather. I think we knew we were going to a place where the weather's going to change all day long. You're going to get rained on. Ultimately the weather in many ways agreed with us, but it was, it's interesting. I've worked in, winter settings, I've worked in snow. We just shot up here in Calgary in the dead of winter. I've been in Bulgaria in the dead of winter. I've been in Chicago. I've been in very cold temperatures and shot in those elements. There was something about the damp, cold nights in the Pacific Northwest that was some of the most challenging weather and environment I've ever dealt with, in terms of when it's that wet, you can never get warm. You're always cold. You're always wet. So, I just remember those night shoots. We were there where you really just kind of felt it in your bones. And so it was, I mean, there's a certain fun in doing these kind of arduous shoots. And this one, you kind of knew we were going to be getting into it, doing it. And it sort of delivered that. So there's a part of me that really enjoys that, but it certainly lived up to the challenge. And I think everyone felt it. And, you know, every day, especially we were there in the fall. So the sun's going down at 5 p.m. I mean, every day at wrap when you drove home, it was pitch black. You know, we're an hour outside of the city where we were staying. So you did this 1 hour long drives at night, every night. And it was like the whole thing was a physical challenge. I mean, mostly for our actors and stunt people. You know, they were just sitting there getting dumped on by rain towers and all of that. But looking back on it, the weather kind of really, while it was tough, it kind of did what we wanted it to, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, especially in the fall, you go there in the Northwest, the clouds just kind of sit there. It's just this gray sky that you feel most of the time. Ooh. And then we went back for a few, we had scheduled a few days of shooting to come later on. And we went back during the summer for those last few days. And it was really beautiful at that time. It's a lovely place in the summer. The fall is pretty dreary.
There's a conversation I've had with a lot of filmmakers over the years is to do with mobile phones and how they're the bane of a lot of filmmakers, because you've got to think of ways to write them out. And some of the filmmakers that I've talked to, just to do with Grimfest, in the last few days, their film's been set in the 70s before the phones and so on. And hand on heart, John, out of all the films I've seen for phones being written out, now mobile phones are used within this film and a very tense way of using them as well. But there's one specific scene where the use of a mobile phone is written out, and hand on heart, it's the best way I've seen on a film for a mobile phone to be written out, John. So congratulations. We sat here and absolutely loved it.
That's great. Well, credit to Matthias. Those were in his script. And yeah, you're right that the mobile phone is the bane of our existence. You know, I think it was really the bane of our existence in thinking about it, you know, 10 years ago when you thought about, oh, so, you know, we don't get it. You can't do any more phone booths because phone booths are so cool. They're so cinematic, you know, yeah. I love when the character goes to the phone booth, but we really can't do that anymore. But I think what I like about Matthias's take on it was he kind of, And we really tried to do that visually as well, as kind of put the phone front and center as, like, again, it's sort of a character in the movie. It's hanging out from the first 60 seconds of the movie till the end.
Yeah.
It's a factor. And in many ways, I think Matthias was very clever in kind of dangling it out there to be like, okay, how are we going to use this to, is it going to lose reception? Is she going to lose it? Is he going to, you know, it's almost like confronting all of your expectations and then somehow managing to keep that character of the phone alive throughout the movie and have it really even play into climactic situations in, I think, a clever and not contrived way, in a way that is actually satisfying. So I think that was, you know, all Matthias's concept on the page. And I love the use of it because, yes, I've many times, you know, been working on things and writing things where you're like, okay, how do we get rid of the phone? Let's just get rid of the phone. What do we do to get rid of the phone? And then after a while, you start to realize, and what I appreciate about what Matthias did is that it goes beyond getting rid of the phone, because you have to reckon with the phone. It's a big part of our lives. So just getting rid of it is a bit of a cheat.
Yeah, we really did. We sat here and we cheered. We went, yes, it was such a great way. And it was, I think it was as well with all the tension that was built up watching it. It was once we saw the way that that had happened, it was, as small as it was, a little bit of a release for us with the how ingenious it was. Before we wrap this up, though, John, there's one thing I've got to ask you, and I just want to circle back to something you said earlier on about going into a filmmaker's work and starting partway through. For anybody watching this on the video show and listening to the audio show, where would you recommend people would start with you? If they go, oh, okay, John Hyams, yeah, I want to see what he's all about. What would you recommend as the starting point for you?
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, I think it probably applies to me as well, because the first things I did were documentaries. And so very different from all this. And I think most people, anyone who probably, who knows who I am, their entry point was probably Universal Soldier: Day of Reckoning. That's probably most people's entry point. That's the first time that many, journalists wrote about something that I did that put my name out there in any way, in the kind of cult genre film space. And I think it's a good entry point, actually, because Day of Reckoning in many ways was a culmination of a lot of everything I'd done before that. And if you look at the things before that, which, before that I did Regeneration and Dragon Eyes, and then, but then going back to my two documentaries, I mean, you can start with documentaries if you like documentaries, but I think it's kind of, that would be an interesting way to go backwards that way and see those. And then moving forwards, I mean, of course, right now, Black Summer, that's really what I've been spending the last several years doing. And to me, I wouldn't have been able to do Black Summer without Alone. Alone kind of taught me something. And in any way, I did two features back to back. So I did a film called All Square, which was actually a kind of a dramatic comedy, very, very different from anything else I've done. And then Alone, I shot those in the space of 6 months, probably.
Wow.
But they ultimately, editorial of those had a different pace because I then got into Black Summer soon after that. But I think all of those things show, you can kind of trace, as with any filmmaker, you can just trace what they last did and how that influences the next thing. And for me, those two chances to make, to get back into features after not having done them for a number of years. And especially Alone, which I really was, I think in All Square was just focusing on, in that case, working with some incredible actors and the gift of that, the gift of working with some really brilliant performers and seeing the value that in the end, whatever tricks you're doing as a filmmaker, whatever craft, whatever cool shot you came up with, it's all sort of meaningless if the people you're pointing the camera at aren't just captivating. And it's really all about them. It's like, you can be the best band in the world, but you live and die by your lead singer. And that's it, and there are lead singers, and if you with a great front man, you can change everyone out behind them, really, because you want to see that front man. And so All Square reinforced that in my mind because it was a chance to work with, brilliantly talented actors and Michael Kelly and Pam Adlon, Harris Yulin, Isaiah Whitlock, Josh Lucas, Tom Everett Scott, just great, great actors. And then Alone, again, a chance to work with brilliant actors, but really working on suspense and tension and really taking on the thriller genre in a way I'd always wanted to, because before that I'd been kind of pulled into some action cinema, but suspense and thrillers, those are always my favorite movies are in their heart thrillers. Even Apocalypse Now is a thriller, in its core. I mean, Taxi Driver is a thriller in its own right. Sicario is a thriller. Like, these are all great movies that do so much more than just be a simple thriller, but the engine that pulls you along is that they're suspense thrillers. So I love the versatility of that genre. And in many ways, Black Summer, yeah, some people may say it's a zombie genre, but I don't look at it that way. To me, it's a thriller. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a show that is a suspense thriller.
Yeah.
And it happens to deal with, you know, the end of times. But so I think that, yeah. Anyway, to answer your question, Day of Reckoning is probably a good entry point.
It is. That's a great one. And Regeneration. Yeah. I love both of those too. Well, for cool. the sake of the edit, John, I will wrap this up. Again, thank you so much for spending some time with me. I can't wait for everybody to watch Alone at Grimfest. I'm sure they're going to absolutely love it. I'm going to watch it again when Grimfest starts at the beginning of October. I'll get rid of these nails first, so I'm not going to dig them too much into the couch this time. But I'm looking forward to watching it again. But just for the sake of the edit, thank you, John, and wish you luck in everything going forward. And let's hope we do get some normality and you can carry on doing what you do.
I hope so. Thanks so much, Dave. I appreciate you taking the time to chat. I appreciate you watching the movie. And thanks for giving us a platform to let other people know about it. Because, you know, this is I'm thrilled that we're in Grimfest. It's been, you know, these last couple festivals has been great between Fantasia Fest and now Grimfest, and the people I'm talking to. This is how we can get this movie to the people that I know will appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, John. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Take care.
And the alarm bell, as always, brings to an end another interview show. Just one more to go in this series of 7 Grimfest shows. Hopefully, again, you've enjoyed them as much as I enjoyed recording them. I'm sure you are going to enjoy the films just as much too. Make sure you get those Grimfest passes. Speaking of which, the Grimfest pass, the free one that you can get for a loan, the word that you have got to email me is trees. Just send that to me, be the first, and you get a free Grimfest pass to watch alone. You can email it to me via our website, 60mw.co.uk. There's a contact us form on there. Or you can email us direct, which is contact@60mw.co.uk. Give us a follow on Instagram and Twitter. Both of those are @60mwpodcast. And as I said at the beginning of the show, give us a sub on YouTube too. All the links will be in the podcast notes. And so, until tomorrow, when it's the 7th and final of these Grimfest interview shows, thank you for listening. And goodbye.